Good afternoon. Welcome everyone to this Treasure Seminar part of the fourth series. It is my great pleasure to introduce Per Kverne, a friend and colleague from Norway. Per is Professor Emeritus at the University of Oslo, where he has served 32 years as Professor of History of Religions. His research covers a huge range of topics, but his main focus has been Tibetan Bön religion, on which he has published really extensively. And a proof of that is a very recent book, which is just being printed out right now, put together with Dan Martin, which includes a translation of Bön, a historical chronicle, a rare text from the 12th century. The book is called Drenpa's Proclamation, The Rise and Decline of the Bön Religion in Tibet, and has been published by Vajra Publications in Kathmandu. So this is where you should go to get a copy. And I hope very much that Per will also show us how the book actually looks like, because we've been hearing about it over all these years when the work was in progress, and it has been a lot of work. Yeah, thank you, Per, and welcome everyone.
Now, the phenomenon of sacred texts hidden for generations and then discovered and made use of when the time is ripe, has been elucidated from various cultural and religious contexts in the course of this seminar series. Lest anyone should think that this is a phenomenon restricted to the Indo-Tibetan sphere, I would like to remind you of the talk by the anthropologist Charles Stewart, which was given on the 3rd of November last year. It has been downloaded as a podcast, so you can listen to it at any time. In his book, Charles Stewart shows how Greek Orthodox Christian icons have been, according to local belief, unearthed on the Greek island of Naxos by locals to whom their location was revealed in dreams. Subsequently, the icons became the focus of extensive devotion on a national level, and the place of the discovery has been developed into a major pilgrimage goal, which it still is today. Now, a similar phenomenon, but involving texts rather than paintings, has been widespread in Tibet since at least the 11th century, and has been a major source of religious authority and prestige until this day. Such texts are called terma, treasures. Crucial constituent parts of the Buddhist, hence dominant narrative of Tibetan history and identity, are anchored in certain texts that are considered to be such terma. As we shall see, the same is true in the case of the Bön religion. The phenomenon of terma has been explored by a number of scholars, such as Janet Gatzko, Michael Aris, and Dan Martin. A remarkable book by Tulku Dundrup Rinpoche, entitled Hidden Teachings of Tibet, an Explanation of the Terma Tradition of the Nyingma School of Buddhism, was published in 1986 and deserves to be mentioned among the early studies as well. However, Robert Meyer has made a particularly important contribution by opening up the vistas of the larger range of hidden text phenomena, not only in the Tibetan, but in other Buddhist traditions as well, notably India and China. This broad approach has characterized the treasure seminar, and I'm sure it will take a long time for everyone to digest all the new information and insight which has been presented in the course of these lectures. However, my talk this afternoon is not on the Dharma of Shakyamuni and its developments in India and Tibet. The focus is on Bön, or as its adherents call it, Yungdung Bön, Eternal Bön, a Tibetan religion which claims a completely different origin. Before proceeding, I have to make it clear that the term Bön is an ambiguous one. To clarify it, I suggest that we distinguish between four uses of the term. First, the term Bön probably basically means ritual, but it is also used to designate a cluster of various non-Buddhist religious beliefs and practices on the Tibetan plateau during the period of the Tibetan Empire, 7th to 9th centuries. These beliefs and practices do not necessarily form a codified or even coherent religious system. They are documented mainly from the Tibetan imperial court, but they by no means exclusively reflect the courtly culture of the centralized Tibetan empire. They're evidenced by pillar and rock inscriptions in central Tibet, as well as annalistic and of particular importance for what we're discussing here, ritualistic texts, especially from the cache, the so-called library of manuscripts discovered in the Buddhist caves at Dunhuang in northwestern China at the beginning of last century. We therefore know something about the rituals of Bön in this sense, but we have no reason to believe that Bön at this time represented a centralized or well-organized doctrinal system, nor, as is sometimes maintained, that it had a shamanistic character, even in a loose sense. It might have had such a character, but the fact is that we do not know. Second, the term Bön may be used, at least for reasons of convenience, to cover beliefs and practices at the local level in the 10th to 12th centuries, that is, after the demise of the Tibetan Empire, occasionally, but not always, with antecedents in the imperial period. What sources are ritual and mythological texts, especially those found in the Gatang Stupa in Lhokha in southeastern central Tibet in 2006 and published in Lhasa the following year. These texts have elicited considerable scholarly response by, among others, John Beleza, Daniel Berunsky, Tony Huber, and Charles Ramble. The Gatang texts are important as they, to some degree, bridge the gap between the old Tibetan texts of the imperial period and the scriptures of eternal Bön, which constitute our next category. So the third meaning of Bön is documented by post-10th century texts and accompanying rituals and beliefs, which by then, by the 10th century or early 11th century at the latest, were in the process of coalescing, probably in central Tibet, into a religion styling itself eternal Bön. This is a religious phenomenon existing, indeed in some respects flourishing until the present day in Tibet and now also in exile and even among Western adherents. It will henceforth be the center of attention of my talk. Eternal Bön is not unconnected with the preceding category, that is the Gatang manuscripts and so on, but at the same time, this new complex religion borrowed a wide range of cosmological ideas, meditational techniques, and philosophical concepts from Buddhism. It must be emphasized that in this relationship, Buddhism also received elements from Bön, such as the cult of the Lu, the aquatic and subterranean spirits, equated to some extent with the Indian Naga. Finally, there exists a wide range of still current religious beliefs and practices, chiefly along the Himalayan margins of the Tibetan Plateau, including Nepal, that are sometimes, but not always, referred to locally as Bön. These phenomena, to some extent, continue beliefs and practices from the second category, and they may or may not be influenced by eternal Bön. Tony Huber, in his monumental study, Source of Life, has provided a uniquely detailed study of such ritual specialists, whom he refers to as shamans, in northeastern Bhutan and the adjacent areas of Arunachal Pradesh. The almost vanished tradition of ritual specialists called Liu on the Qinghai-Gansu border and their vast literary heritage of ritual texts should probably also be placed in this category. It is crucial to distinguish these four meanings of the term Bön, which are related to each other, although to varying degrees and in ways which are still far from clear. I would like to repeat that there are no Tibetan texts or inscriptions from the imperial period that can be securely dated earlier than the 7th century of the Common Era. It is therefore misleading to refer to Burm in the imperial period as pre-Buddhist. Before proceeding, I should make two further clarifications. First, I consider, as you already will have understood, that the Burm religion, that is, Yungdung Burm, is a distinct religion in spite of its sharing a large number of elements with Buddhism in Tibet. My main reason for asserting this is that from the point of view of the adherents of Yungdung Burm, their doctrine, although eternal and unchanging, was founded, as far as our present cosmic era is concerned, by the enlightened teacher Trungpa Shenrab, the ruler of the realm of Umulungring, situated vaguely in the western part of our continent of Jambudvipa, hence not at all in India. Moreover, he is believed to have lived many thousands of years before Shakyamuni. In fact, Shakyamuni is sometimes stated in Yungdung Burm texts to have been a divine prince who was ordered by Trungpa Shenrab, living in one of the heavens, but ordered by Trungpa Shenrab to take birth in India as a human to overcome a demon who was propagating a false doctrine. The divine being, so the narrative goes, is born as a prince in the Shakya clan, and as such, successfully overcomes the demon, thus establishing Chur, that is, Dharma, the Dharma of Shakyamuni, which ultimately is no different from eternal Burm. In other words, Buddhism is, according to a prevalent view among the adherents of Burm, simply an ad hoc form of Burm. This is why I maintain that it is reasonable to regard Burm as a distinct religion. In this characterization, I follow the understanding of the adherents of Burm themselves, but of course, as a historian, I have to maintain that just as in the case of Buddhism, as it became in the form that became dominant in Tibet, the origins of Yungdung Burm must in the main be sought in the period of the second propagation of Buddhism in Tibet, in other words, in the late 10th century and the following centuries. Given that, according to Burm, there is ultimately no irreconcilable difference between Burm and Buddhism, one may ask why there nevertheless tends to exist, according to Burm, an antagonistic relationship between the two religions. The standard Burm narrative is that while the Dharma of Shakyamuni is true and pure, it was, in course of time, mixed with what Burmese texts call the evil spells of India, and hence became a false and a harmful doctrine. The propagator of this evil chur, this evil dharma in Tibet, was, above all, the Indian tantric master Padmasambhava, who gained the favor of the Tibetan emperor Trisong Detsen and persuaded the latter to banish the Burm priests from his realm. Thus, by means of this narrative, those who wish to establish pre-Buddhist credentials during the second propagation of Buddhism in Tibet could explain why Burm shared basic elements of doctrine with Buddhism and at the same time explain why Buddhism, as introduced into Tibet during the Tibetan Empire, was a pernicious and perverted doctrine. When the Burm priests were expelled from Tibet in the 8th century by Emperor Trisong Detsen, the later Yungdung Burm narrative maintained that the priests took some of their sacred texts with them and that they hid others in various places, mostly in central Tibet. These hidden texts, or terma, were to be rediscovered or literally extracted in the future, thus ensuring that the doctrine of Burm would be propagated and flourish once more. This largely parallels the Buddhist narrative, which emerged at the same time, that is from the 11th century onwards, according to which, of course, Padmasambhava is the hero, the omniscient master who hid Buddhist texts for the benefit of future generations. When the study of Bön, of Yungdung Bön, was established in the West in the mid and late 1960s, it soon became clear that this religion, just like Buddhism in Tibet, possessed a vast corpus of sacred texts dating from various periods, although none of them could be dated to the Tibetan Empire or even before the 10th century. It was also clear that a large number of the texts, perhaps the majority, at least of the older ones, were Terma. However, before we can develop this topic of Terma further, I have to say something about two seminal works that were published at this early stage of Bön studies in the West, that is, in the late 1960s and early 1970s. The first was a selection of passages translated from Tibetan by David Snellgrove, with the help of a learned Bumpo monk, Tenzing Namdak, from a 12-volume 14th century work entitled The Ziji. Attributed to a Bön visionary, Loden Nyingpo was born in 1360, his year of death unknown, but probably 1406. These selected passages gave a systematic presentation of the entire range of Bön doctrine and rituals organized by the Bumpos in what they call the Tekpagu, the nine ways or vehicles corresponding to the Sanskrit term yana. A study of these texts led Snellgrove to the conclusion that Yungdung Bön comprises the entire range of religious beliefs and practices in Tibet, from divination and magic to the most sophisticated philosophical speculation. In this respect, the profile, if we can use that term, of Yungdung Bön is very similar to that of the Buddhist Nyingma tradition, which emerged as a specific school during the later propagation at the turn of the first millennium, that is, at about the same time as Yungdung Bön, and has much the same kind of eclectic or all-inclusive nature. The other work is a translation with an important introduction by Samtin Gyaltsen Karmé of a historical narrative by a Bön scholar, Sharza Tashi Gyaltsen, dating from the 1920s. Samtin Gyaltsen himself came from a Bön community in the Tibeto-Chinese borderlands, but had settled in the West by the early 1960s and soon became and has remained a brilliant and prolific scholar. This historiographic work is particularly detailed when it comes to explaining how, when, and where a large number of Bön treasures came to light. The title of the book is The Treasury of Good Sayings, The Tibetan History of Bön, the Lekshe Tzu. Now, combining the rich information in this book, which extensively quotes older sources, with the chronological data offered in a tenzi, a chronological table composed in 1842 by the celebrated Bumpo scholar Nyima Tenzing, who was born in 1813, a tenzi which I had published and translated in Acta Orientalia in 1971, it is possible to establish at least a tentative chronological framework for the post-imperial Yungdung Bön religion. A couple of years later, basing myself on a catalogue of the Bön canonical scriptures by the same scholar, Nyima Tenzing, I presented a complete, although very summary inventory of all the texts contained in the Bön canon, which is referred to by the Bumpos as the Katten, or, as with the Buddhists, as the Kanjur. The inventory was published in the Indo-Iranian Journal in 1974. For each text, the inventory states whether the text in question is a terma and who the treasure finder is. So by combining this information with the references in the Treasury of Good Sayings and the chronology of Nyima Tenzing, a picture emerged of the Bön corpus of canonical scriptures. After this long, but I think necessary contextual presentation I shall finally turn to the actual Burman hidden texts, their chronology and classification, based on the works of Nyingmar Tenzing. It is true that a deeper study of the works of other and more detailed catalogues of the Burman Kanjo, which have become available since the 1970s, would provide many adjustments, refinements, and of course, fresh problems, but the outline which I shall present here would not, I think, be fundamentally altered. For those, however, who would like to study more detailed catalogues, not to mention the composition and contents of the entire Kanjo, I refer to the introduction written by Dan Martin in the work entitled A Catalogue of the Burman Kanjo, edited by Dan Martin, Yasuhiko Nagano, and myself, published in Osaka by the National Museum of Ethnology in 2003. According then to Burman narratives, the coming to light of hidden Burman texts began in 913 of the Common Era. Personally, I feel the date can be questioned as perhaps being somewhat early. Be that as it may, the earliest discovery, or at least one of the earliest, according to Yungdrung Burn, took place at the Buddhist monastery of Samye, a monastery dating back to the 8th century. The protagonists here are three errant monks, Atsara, it says, Sanskrit Acharya, from Nepal, who were not Bumpos at all. Their sole purpose, it is said, in coming to Samye, was to obtain gold by fair means or foul. At Samye they found a box and stole it in the belief that it contained gold. To their disappointment, one must assume, the contents turned out to be books, so later they exchanged some of the books for food and continued their wanderings. The colorful account of this event, as narrated in the Treasury of Good Sayings, and translated by something else in Karme, is worth quoting. It gives an impression of their authenticity, not least because of the complete absence of supernatural elements. So I shall read somewhat abridged quotation from this text. Because of news reaching the heirs of the three Nepalese acharyas that one could get all the gold one wanted in Tibet, on inquiring, they were told that in Samye there was a lot of gold. They went to Samye. As they were performing circumambulations and the like, the custodian of the temple led them into the temple and then went away, closing the door. The Nepalese saw a box sealed with bronze. On lifting it, they found it was very heavy. Thinking it must be gold, they took it. They reached a place in the valley of Nyanlam. There they broke the seal and looked inside. A tiger bag, a leopard bag, and a bear bag were revealed. On being opened, they were found to be full of burned texts. Then they proceeded to Tolung. By the time they arrived there, their victuals had run out. And so one stayed behind to look after the bags. And as the other two were searching for food, they heard drumbeats in the village. They asked what was going on there and were told that a Bumpo called Taji Trilse was performing a rite. They told him that they had some burnt texts and were going to give them to him. In return, they begged for food. So he gave them beer, a load of barley flour, and a carcass of meat. They returned with him and told him he could take one volume. He took out one volume from the bear bag. It was the burn rite of the Makbo Gyusum, the basic text together with its commentary. End of quote. It is worth noting that this discovery, if one may call it that, was made at Samye. The importance of this monastery, the oldest in Tibet, founded by the Emperor Trisong Detsen in the latter part of the 8th century, is well known. In the later religious epics centering on Padmasambhava and the establishment of Buddhism in Tibet, it is, at least in some sources, narrated that soon after its foundation, not only Buddhist, but also Burman texts were translated into Tibetan at Samye, the Buddhist text translated, of course, from Sanskrit, and the Burn text translated from the language of Shangxiong. Now, Shangxiong was a kingdom conquered by the Tibetans in the 7th century, and subsequently considered by the adherents of Yongdong Burn, once they appeared on the scene, as a realm where their texts had been preserved for centuries before finally being translated into Tibetan. This is supposed to have happened in the temple of Avalokiteshvara at Samye on the orders of Emperor Chisong Detsen. In fact, the Burn historiographical narrative, which Anna kindly referred to in her introduction, dating from the 12th century, Drenpa's proclamation, and which is probably earlier than the fully developed Padmasambhava epic, emphasizes the ambiguous relationship of the emperor towards Buddhism as well as Burn. In any case, there's no doubt that in the 10th to 11th century, there was a period of change and innovation in Tibetan history, in the course of which the multiple religious traditions from which ultimately various Buddhist schools emerged, as well as Yongdong Burn. Not only the Samye Terma found by the three Nepalese acharyas, but a number of other early hidden treasures appeared to have been discovered by accident. Thus, in 962, a crack in the pillar at Samye disclosed burnt texts of which Kowo Yeongom Tarmo is considered the discoverer. We also hear of texts buried in the ground being discovered by hunters digging for a stone, perhaps to make a fireplace. Having no interest in the texts, they simply sold them. Likewise, we are told of a group of Buddhists in the 11th century who were looking for Buddhist texts at Yerbao Zong near Lhasa, but finding only burnt texts, they sold them. We also hear about guidebooks, kachang, often come across by chance, which describe how to find a particular terma. This was the case with the treasure revealer Kutsadawa, who was born in 1024, who discovered texts at Paro in present-day Bhutan. The guide was given to him by his father. So it's quite a prosaic thing. It was given to him in compensation for not legally recognizing his son as legal, you see. So he got this guide and he set off, reached Paro, and the Treasury of Good Sayings tells us that, I quote, he began to dig according to the measurements in the guide. He found a rocky cave with four doors. Inside the first door, there was a flat bell. In the second, an upright bell. In the third, a horoscope chart, and in the fourth, a razor. With the flat bell, there appeared burnt texts. With the upright bell, Buddhist texts. With the horoscope chart, astrological texts. And with the razor, medical texts. It's worth noting that the burnt texts constitute only one part of the texts discovered. This is often the case with early burnt terma. It is possible to see a succession of three stages in the history of the appearance of hidden texts in the Burn religion in the period I'm focusing on, that is from the 10th to the 14th century. The first period is the one we have already dealt with, that is the period which we can, grosso modo, assigned to the 10th and 11th century. In a number of cases, these texts came to light by chance, and their discoveries are characterized by the absence of supernatural elements. The individuals who make the actual discoveries are often depicted as unaware or uninterested in the texts, which have unexpectedly come into their hands, and they sometimes seem to be at a loss what to do with them. However, after this initial period, in the course of the 11th and 12th century, the discoveries tend to be surrounded with increasing frequency by supernatural phenomena, such as premonitory dreams, visions, prophecies, etc. an extremely important figure at the beginning of this second period, which to some extent overlaps with the end of the first, is Shenzhen Luga. He's a key figure in the history of Burmese hidden texts, and this discovery dated to 1017 include numerous important texts. What distinguishes him, however, was that the discovery was preceded by several years of preparation, culminating in a series of visions in which supernatural beings of various kinds revealed their place with a cache of texts, the terma, were hidden. Shenzhen Luga has been studied in depth by Dan Martin in his book Unearthing Burmese Treasures, published in 2001. And I recommend this work to anyone who is interested in the broader phenomenon of terma. Here's an excerpt from a 14th century text quoted by Dan Martin, which purports to reproduce Shenzhen Luga's own words. So I quote, "When I reached my 13th year, my father said, 'You and Hagekke, run along and pick white gentian and tinta.' So we went. I left Gekke to pick gentian, and I went to find tinder in a further valley, where a voice spoke from the sky, saying, 'Shen Luga, shall I bestow the spiritual power on Burn? The place where I stood shook, and a crevice in the rock was filled with liquid. Thinking this to be the spiritual power, I kept it secret even from my parents." Then, I abridge a bit here, then followed 6 years of various adventures, during which he became partly crippled due to his back being broken. He then turned to religion and requested various teachings and initiations from a Burmese Lama. As a result of this, his spiritual power, which had been lost, reappeared. However, his father died, so he had to spend several years on the memorial observances, and later he had to marry. But after some years, supernatural signs started reappearing, such as, I quote, "a black woman, her locks of hair pressing against her shoulders, her angry fangs bared as if ready to eat something." Undaunted, he continued on his way, and at the place called Drakkar, he was met by many children with turquoise ornamented topknots and women dressed in fine white cloth. They prostrated, gave offerings, and scattered flowers. I sat without expressing delight in this, and they disappeared, so that I had no idea where they went." Finally, after many similar visions, he is led to a rock under which a textual treasure was hidden. It was covered by a large boulder, which he was able to remove. And I quote, "Below that was another square boulder with two swastikas drawn on it, one in vermilion, the other in crystal. I took the boulder out, and there were two small boxes. In the larger box were many burn texts, but no sooner had he taken them out than they disappeared." I continue to quote the text now. "In the evening, a black woman and a black man came and said, 'Do not take away these things of ours. When you extract them, set up as their substitute a white sheep with vermilion eyes and a white yak with red forehead spot.' Apparently, he was not prepared to offer the substitute, so he took only the smaller box, leaving the big one in its place. In the small box, he found a number of important burn texts. It is somewhat puzzling why the box was called small, since the sheer weight and volume of the texts it is stated to have contained would have been significantly heavier than one person could even possibly carry. At other times, the part played by the supernatural was more discreet. Thus, in 1067, a shepherd later known as Nyentan Sherpa Dorje followed a ray of light which led to a crack in the rock and thus discovered, I quote, a cave full of volumes of books all round the walls. In other words, physical texts were found in the physical place, but only thanks to a supernatural sign, a ray of light that comes out from the crack. The name of this particular treasure discoverer, Sherpa Dorje, suggests that he might in fact have been a Buddhist rather than a Bumpo, once again indicating that the borderline between the two religions was not particularly rigid. It is not necessary to enumerate all the following tetram, but two points should be mentioned. First, often only a certain part of the treasure in question was actually extracted, so it is implied that the remainder was left in place, awaiting discovery later at a suitable time in the future. Thus, the rediscovery of the teachings of Bön is not yet a completed process. Second, the guardian deities who watch over the treasures sometimes prevented the original texts from being removed, only permitting the Tertön to copy them in situ, thus ensuring the possibility of the rediscovery in the future. A third stage in the history of Bön, of the Bön hidden texts, was initiated at the beginning of the 12th century with the appearance of texts which were said to have been orally transmitted, Nyendu Jipa, that is, dictated to the Tertön by supernatural beings in the course of a vision. This is not really a third stage in the strictly chronological sense, but rather a new category of discoveries, which to some extent overlaps with those of the second stage. The point here is that we're dealing not only with a quantitative, but above all, a qualitative increase in the supernatural element in the process of revelation. We hear of texts being transmitted orally, apparently for the first time, in the case of a treasure discoverer called Jeremy Niwe, to whom they were said to have been transmitted by Drempa Namka. The year is unknown, but it most likely would have been early in the 12th century, as this person discovered other texts in 1108. Another oral transmission from the same period was bestowed on a certain Lungbern Tanyan, who was born in 1088. There follows an unbroken series of other visionaries to whom texts are dictated by supernatural beings. For the 12th century alone, the Treasure of Good Sayings mentions at least six, among them the important figure of Yiltern Pönse Kyungötsel. In the second half of the 14th century, we find a group of particularly important visionaries, chief one being Kyungpo Lodan Nyingpo, who was born, as I said before, in 1360, and among whose transmissions are counted not only the 12-volume Ziji, in which David Snellgrove took excerpts for his book, but also numerous other texts. Finally, certain other texts, accepted as authoritative, are regarded as having arisen in the mind of treasure finders without any divine mediation. This is referred to as Gongpar Sharwa, or simply as luminous letters, Wurki Jigar Bapa, which sort of descend into the mind spontaneously of the treasure discoverer. A subgroup of this kind of revelation consists of texts written in what is called symbolic letters, Dayik, which are deciphered, by the recipient in question. It's just like a few syllables, but they contain a whole text once they are read and deciphered and reveal their contents to the treasure discoverer. Or there can be texts which are said to have been written in the script of the pure gods. So the treasure discoverer is someone who's able to read that script when the texts arise in his mind. Sometimes the entire group of non-material revelations, with or without divine intervention, are called gongter, mental treasures, as opposed to texts which exist physically before being discovered, again, with or without divine intervention. The latter texts are known as Sater, earth treasures. The main part of this survey will end with the 14th century, because that seems to be the century in which a selection of the vast range of texts which were already in circulation in Jungdong-Bön were constituted as a canonical corpus, the criterion being that the chosen texts were considered to be the actual words of the ultimate authority of the doctrine, namely the word of Trungpa Shenrab. This corpus, as I've pointed out, is still known as the Ka Ten, alternatively as the Kanjur. And it was created more or less at the same time as the Buddhist Kanjur, except, of course, that the source of authority was different, the Buddhists tracing the texts that they accepted back to Shakyamuni. Just as in the case of the Buddhists, the formation of the scriptural canon was a slow process, with texts claimed by some to be authentic ending up by being rejected. Similar controversies took place among the Buddhists, resulting in the collection of the Nyingma Gyubum, a collection of tantras which was gradually constituted within the Nyingma school, but were rejected by the editors of the Buddhist Kanjur in the 14th century as not being authentic translations of Indian originals. Regarding similar controversies in the Burn community, the Treasury of Good Sayings quotes a verse warning us that, and I quote it, "The country is full of false, lying, and specious textual treasures, and of such as have no knowledge of the doctrine and are fond of arguing and of women." Lest one should be led to believe that discovering hidden treasures in the context of Burn is a phenomenon which only belongs to a distant past, I would like to quote from a contemporary eyewitness account of the disclosing of a treasure, in this case, consisting not of texts, but objects, by a female Burn treasure discoverer in Kongpo, in southeastern central Tibet in 1986. The witness in question is Span Hanna, a lady from Australia, who in September 1986 encountered the group of Tibetans in Kongpo who were planning to make a circumambulation of the sacred mountain of Burnri in southeastern central Tibet. This mountain, as the name indicates, is particularly sacred to Bumpos. The group was led by a woman named Kandru Kache Wangmu, was considered to be a Terta. Actually, she was the youngest of five children of a famous Tertan, Humchen Drodu Lingpa, who lived from 1901 to 1956, who had revealed treasures at Burnri in the past. Her brother is referred to by Span Hanna, as Rinpoche. As we know from other sources, his name was Mengye Lhase. Not long after Span Hanna's encounter with her, Kachi Wangmo passed away between 1987 and 89. Hanna has given a lively account of the days she spent with the extraordinary Tibetan woman in an article entitled "Vast as the Sky, the Terma Tradition in Modern Tibet." You'll see the full reference in a moment. She writes that after a couple of days of walking, the group, which Span Hanna had joined, reached the circumambulation path. After following the track for a day or two, reached a rock which Kandru asserted contained a terma. At this point, I shall quote a passage from Span Hanna's account. "A shrine was quickly assembled about 50 yards from the rock. Biscuits, sweets, and fruits were laid out on a large cloth. At the head of the cloth were placed some pictures of deities, butter lamps, a framed photo of the father of Kandru and of Rinpoche, and Rinpoche's ceremonial dagger called a pupa. At least 100 people were gathered on the narrow path. Vultures were seen wheeling in the sky above, and this was taken to be an auspicious sign. Then, as the weather cleared, Kondro suddenly got to her feet and began moving towards the rock. She had stripped to the waist and was carrying Rinpoche's pupa. When Kondro reached the rock, she struck it with the pupa, not violently, but as if testing it. As she turned momentarily to face the crowd, a delicate but arresting sound of a clear small bell rang out, soft and quickly fading. As soon as it sounded, Kondro climbed a little way up the rock and began striking it again. Svanhanna was able to take a few photos of this event as it happened. And she doesn't give captions, but I imagine this is more or less at this moment when she is halfway up the rock and strikes it for the second time. A noticeable thrill passed through the crowd as Kondro removed a slab of stone. This caused my stomach to drop, almost as if I were watching surgery being performed. Kondro removed several more slabs of stone, perhaps five in all. Then she reached into the cavity she had made and turned back to the crowd, holding her hand aloft for all to see. She had removed a small seated figurine, perhaps 2 inches high. As the crowd chanted with fresh enthusiasm, Kondro reached into the cavity again, this time producing a dorje about the same size as the figurine. I imagine this is more or less the moment which is described here. It is impossible to describe the feeling which swept through the crowd then, and it was impossible not to be caught up in it oneself. For a while, I don't think I really knew where I was, until the crowd about me began to swarm forward to see the two objects. Kondro held them up, one in each hand, as the crowd gathered around her, offering scarves and valuables. They were subsequently replaced in the rock in exchange for the terem. At this point, I leave the account. For the purposes of understanding the phenomenon of terma, it is of little importance whether the entire seance was simply the result of sleight of hand. What is important is to note the mechanism of discovery, which is entirely in accordance with what one might call classical terma discoveries, and equally important that the group of pilgrims for whose edification the discovery was made expressed strong emotion and unquestioning faith in the supernatural nature of what they had witnessed. It is also worth noting that Svanhanna writes that when the crowd came to receive the blessings of Kondro and Rinpoche after they had returned to the local administrative center, I quote, "We noticed that they dealt with Buddhists and Bumpus alike, showing no religious partisanship whatsoever." Once, for blessing a prayer wheel, Kondro asked its owner whether he revolved it clockwise or anti-clockwise. Buddhists visiting Burnley on
pilgrimage. In progress.
Circumambulum. Anti-clockwise, as the Bumpus do. As Svanhanna's account illustrates, the terma tradition is often basically non-sectarian, although always identifiable as either Buddhist or Burn. As far as the Burn tradition is concerned, the Burn terma tradition was, especially in its initial phases, frequently free of supernatural elements or circumstances, which might at least suggest that its origins perhaps are to be found in texts which in fact had been physically hidden away. However, as we have no hidden text that can be firmly dated back to the imperial period, the question still needs to be answered why and when the texts were hidden. Perhaps the period during which they were hidden away did not last very long, or perhaps they were not hidden at all, but emerged together with the narratives of their discovery, narratives that served to establish their authenticity in terms of pre-imperial period origins. If this question is ever to be solved, a lot of research still remains to be undertaken, research which has still hardly begun. It's my hope that, and my certainty that, this whole series of lectures on hidden texts will inspire many scholars to pursue this kind of research in what is truly a very important but also very fascinating field. Thank you very much.